clients basically are divided into groups based on your economic capacity. So on a Jewish flight, that means that basically the 5,000 Los Angeles is in group number one, and then you have Teaneck and Westchester in group number two, and then you have Fairlawn and Valley, pretty much anyone who has a Chinese restaurant that's only takeout, that's group number three. And then I live in Passaic, New Jersey, that's group 14. And you are not really allowed to talk to anybody in any other group. That's really one of the rules, you can sort of scream above. But there's always like one woman in group number two who's very, very machped that the only people in line B from group number two. And when you walk up to her and you say to her, "What group is this?" she says with tremendous intensity, "This is group two. This is two. Are you two?" I don't know. I don't know what I am. Well, if you're not two, you're not here. You're not here. There's always one guy who's supposed to be in group one that ended up in group two. And this guy looks at you like you are a peon. Like, what? How could I be in your group? He looks at you like you're going to squeegee his windshield. Like you are like from another, like, don't get your polyester on my yarmulke. Like, who are you to stand in my group? But it's a beautiful thing. I really respect the fact that they always allow military personnel to board the plane first. Since we don't give those people health care, the best we can do is give them an overhead bin. They stay, at least they can put their stuff in, you know, the limbs they have with them, whatever's going on up there with the thing. But it's Baruch Hashem. Now, when you fly United, so you also get to fly with non-Jews, which is always more exciting. And one of the biggest differences between Jews and non-Jews on a United flight on an airplane is, of course, the experience of eating dinner. You see, the rest of the world, when they get a meal on the airplane, they're given food and they have access to this food, pretty much just based on their bechira. Once they choose to eat the food, at that moment, the food is now available. If you are kosher, you are given a titanium-sealed entity. The first thing you try to do is puncture this plastic. You look for a sharp object, but of course it's an airplane. So you try to poke it with your finger, that does not work. You try to tear it, that does not work. Then you try not to let anyone see, but you bite it a little bit. That does not work. Although now you have a chipped tooth. And you're looking at yourself, I think they should build the whole plane out of this material. I think then there'd be no safety concerns whatsoever. You finally get into this food plate, and this plastic seems, when you remove it from the food container, to grow in its mass. It, as it sits with your food, it is 8 times the size than what it was when it was wrapping your food. So you're trying to access this half a kazayas of an omelet that they gave you in a dish that's 8 times the volume of the omelet with a string bean that looks like it's from 1912, and all on your table, which now long is not even big enough for a laptop, is just mounds and mounds of plastic wrapping and aluminum wrapping. And the person next to you, they're just cutting through their souffle and everything's fine. And you, if you want to reach that little piece of pineapple, there's like an audio presentation. You gotta like move it up. And when you're done with your food, you can't get up. You cannot get up to go wash with this stuff on your table. You cannot lift it. It's like 9 pounds of wrapping that is mamish weighing you down and there's nowhere to go. So it's an amazing thing. This journey is unbelievable. Finally, they come to collect it. Everyone else's tray slips right into the United cart. And with you, they have an extra bag. And they're like putting mounds of trash into this thing. All this to eat a meal that you really don't feel 30 seconds later. You don't even know that it happened. It's like an aspirational meal. It's like something that's scheduled. It's like a kiyum in Erev Yom Kippur. It's an amazing experience, but it's all worth it when you land and you're in Eretz Yisrael and you're able to be at the airport and lose your luggage and be part of the full Israeli experience, and it's all amazing. So I always enjoy my journey. I always enjoy coming here, and I always enjoy a few minutes to study Torah together here at Torah Shraga. So I want to share with you an insight. I want to share with you a perspective that relates a little bit to this week's parsha, but is really much more global and much more fundamental to who we are and how we view ourselves and how we live our life. The Gemara tells us in Shabbos, Ha'omed ala meis v'shas yitzias nisham. If somebody finds themselves present at the time that someone passes away, says the Gemara, Chayiv likro, you are obligated to do the mitzvah of kriya, to tear your clothing. I was just at the Kotel yesterday. We do a mitzvah of kriya. We tear our clothing. Says the Gemara, what is the source for this? Lema hazeh domen. What is this comparable to? This notion that if you're there, when someone passes away, you tear kriya. Says the Gemara, le sefer Torah shenisrifa. It is comparable to a sefer Torah that is burning. So we know that in Jewish life, there is nothing more iconic in terms of representing the sanctity, the kedusha of what it means to be a Jew, than a sefer Torah. We have, of course, Seamus. We have constantly with the parsha sheets, burying things in people's backyards, whatever we're doing. I know I have a shul in Passaic, New Jersey. So I always give out shiurim, I give out Mara Makomos. So there's this guy in the shul, this is being taped, there's a guy in the shul who said to me a couple weeks ago, he said to me, I gave out the Mara Makomos, and he goes, more Seamus. So I said, can we agree to at least call it Mara Makomos before the shiur, and then call it Seamus after the shiur? You know, it's like holy trash. So we know that we treat Shem Hashem with incredible Kedusha. There is nothing holier that we can relate to than a Sefer Torah. Anybody who's ever in a shul where the Gabbai gives Hagba to someone who looks like me always holds their breath, right? What was he thinking, right? Maybe he's a lefty. I don't know, right? But we know if a Sefer Torah falls, there's like 19,000 different mystical rumors about what you have to do. Fast for one day, fast for 40 days, never eat again, give tzedakah to YU, do all sorts of things to be mechaper for such a terrible avera. We know a kedusha of a Sefer Torah is unbelievable. So says the Gemara, when a Jew passes away, when a Jew's life comes to an end, this is comparable to the burning of a Sefer Torah. And the question that Rabbi Soloveitchik would ask is, in what way are these two things parallel? The demise of a human being, when it's not in tragic circumstances, which the Gemara does not appear to be necessarily talking about particularly tragic circumstances, is a natural evolution of life. This is what happens in the world. People grow up, they grow old, they pass away. The burning of a Sefer Torah is an unbelievably traumatic experience. The burning of a Sefer Torah is something that we would never want to have anything to do with. The burning of a Sefer Torah is comparable to the death of a person. What do these two things have to do with each other? So if Soloveitchik explained that in Jewish life, in the way in which we approach the world of Kedusha, there is no such thing, and this is a very fundamental point, there is no such thing as inherent Kedusha in this world. The only thing that is inherently holy is the Kaddish Baruch. Everything else that has been endowed with sanctity in this world has achieved that level of Kedusha, that level of holiness, because someone at some point infused it with the intentionality of holiness itself. Even Eretz Yisrael. Eretz Yisrael is a chosen land. Eretz Yisrael is Klal Yisrael's land. It was promised to us. But its halachic status of Kiddush was mechayev us in mitzvahs tluyos ba'aretz, in trumos, in maisos, and shmita, has nothing to do with whether or not Eretz Yisrael was chosen and promised to Avraham Avinu. It has to do with the Kiddusha that is infused by people. When we conquered Eretz Yisrael, we infused it with Kiddusha. In the initial conquest, and then when Klal Yisrael was expelled from Eretz Yisrael, that Kedusha dissipated. It disappeared. And during that period of time, there was no Trumos and Maasos. When Klal Yisrael returned to Eretz Yisrael, they reinvigorated that Kedusha. They reconstituted that Kedusha. And then there's a major, major machlokes rishon, whether or not the rejuvenated Kedusha Shmiya is one that endures la'asid lavo, or one that on a do-raisa level, left with the churban ba'yishemi as well. That has many halachic nafkaminas. But everyone agrees that the Kedusha itself emanates from an experience where people infused it with Kedusha, people infused it with holiness. Explains Rabbi Soloveitchik. What is a Sefer Torah? So we might think a Sefer Torah is holy because its content, its substance, represents the core of our values, our ideals, Devar Hashem. Sitting on this parchment is literally the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What would radiate sanctity more than that? Explains the Rav, that's absolutely not true. You have a dead piece of parchment, and you have a quill, and you have ink. And if you were to put this quill and ink in the hands of a robot, and you were to have the Sefer Torah written automatically from Bereshis Bara to Le'enei Kol Yisrael, and you had every word of Dvar Hashem depicted on this cloth, you would not have one iota of Kedusha Sefer Torah. What makes the Sefer Torah holy? What gives it its Kedusha? The one other ingredient that is core to its creation, and that is the Sofer. The human being, the Jew, the individual who writes the Sefer Torah, infuses that Sefer Torah with its Kedusha. That's what gives the Sefer Torah its sanctity. And in fact, if one of us were to write a Sefer Torah, and the Gadol Hador were to write a Sefer Torah, so maybe his Sefer Torah would be more marketable than ours. Maybe people would be willing to charge more for it than ours. But in terms of crossing the threshold of what qualifies as a kosher Sefer Torah, with all of the dinim of Sefer Torah, there's absolutely no difference whatsoever. Every single Jew has within them the capacity to create a Sefer Torah. And that Sefer Torah is a product of their individuality, of who they are, of the essence of their spirit, of what they contribute to the world, of their talents and their dreams and their capabilities and their lives and their history. That Sefer Torah comes alive with the infusion of the personality of the individual who writes it. I might have told this story last year, I don't remember. But I used to work in outreach. For 15 years, I worked for an organization called NCSY. And I used to go into public schools and do outreach programs. So one year I decided to bring a sofer to a public school. This was a terrible mistake. Sofers love to do demonstrations with all these like half-killed animals. You know what I'm talking about? They like bring you your tefillin. It still has hair on it. It has a little bell. You know, it's like they want to show you that, you know, it really came from a dead animal. Like to really drive the point home. So I bring the sofer and he makes a whole presentation to the students. And he's explaining to them how you write a Sefer Torah. And there's a girl in the back. And the girl is listening to this presentation. And the girl, all of the sudden, and this is a girl who is in the process of becoming frum. Today she is frum. And she stands up in the back and she says, "The Torah is written on a dead animal? I'm a vegetarian. How is that possible? That's the most unethical thing I've ever heard of." So, fearing that we might lose this girl, so that weekend, I went to the store in Timek. And I bought an art scroll Tanakh. And I brought it to the club the next week. And I walked up to her and I said, "Alyssa, here is a vegetarian Torah." And she looked at me and she said, "Rabbi, the cover is leather." We chapter anyone. Anyway. We don't even realize what makes a Sefer Torah a Sefer Torah. It's the power of the individual. It's the ability that we have to ultimately turn something that is lifeless. This is a carcass of an animal. This is a gross, smelly skin of an animal. To turn that into the most sanctified object in all of Jewish life. That occurs through the medium of a human personality. It occurs through us. Every single individual has the capacity to help something come alive. And that individual capability that exists within everyone is one of the most essential elements of who we are that we have to be in touch with, that we have to understand. Because it is part of what shapes
the trajectory of our religious life.
You know, in this week's parsha, Parshas Vayechi,
Yaakov Avinu gathers all of his children because he's about to pass away. And you imagine Yaakov Avinu is going to pass away. This is not a simple family. We've been following the unfolding of events surrounding this family. This is a family that's saturated with jealousy, with competition, with challenges, with some shortcomings. This has not been an easy family to hold together. And one would imagine that Yaakov's final moments with these brothers would be focused on a message of unity, on a message of commonality. Let's talk about what binds us together. Let's talk about the defining elements of what will shape the Jewish people that all of you share. Let's talk about what everyone agrees on. Let's talk about the strand of common purpose that transverses through all of the Shvatim. And yet that's not what Yaakov does. First, Yaakov gives extra brachos to Yosef's children. Then Yaakov Avinu begins to give an individual bracha to each one of the Shvatim, and we're told by the Mefarshim, in front of everyone else. And Yaakov Avinu begins to focus on the shortcomings of this one and the temptations of that one and the accomplishments of this one and the potential of that one. And Yaakov Avinu begins to draw out all of this individuality with each one of these sons. I'm not saying that shouldn't have been a message at some point along the way. But this is what you want to leave them with? You're the unifying figure. Everything that happened in Mitzrayim coalesced around the Shvatim, ultimately being deferential to their father. You're the one that brings this family together. This is what you want to do? You want to point out all the diversity amongst them? It's a value, it's important. So Yaakov Avinu, why is he doing this? The answer is that Yaakov Avinu understood that Klal Yisrael was about to go through a massive transition. The transition was from the world of the others, where Judaism was expressed exclusively through individuals, to the formation of the Klal, where there would be a national identity. And Yaakov Avinu understood that as much as the national identity of Klal Yisrael was crucial to creating the foundation for the people's future, that at the end of the day, what happens when you focus on a national identity is you begin to diminish the individual contributions of each and every person. You begin to dilute how this one is different than that one. And so Yaakov Avinu chooses at this moment to accentuate the diversity of the Shvatim, to show them that each one has their own mission, their own tafkid, their own goal, their own constellation of strengths and weaknesses, their own proclivities, their own approaches to life, their own dispositions. And each one can achieve greatness in their own way. And it's only when you actualize the contribution of each of them individually that you ultimately coalesce into a nation. And in fact, where do the Shvatim emerge? Where are the Shvatim emphasized in the Torah? Before we become a nation, going to Mitzrayim. Again, surrounding the experience of the Mishkan. And again, before we enter Eretz Yisrael. The Mishkan also introduces this unifying form of worship. This genericizing the way tefillah would, now we have karbonos. It's not Avram did it this way and Yitzchak made a mincha and Yaakov chat ma'ariv. Now everybody's going to approach it in a more structured and similar way. We're going into Eretz Yisrael. We're building a state. We're building a country. Can't build a country based on what any individual wants. That's the state of Israel, right? You can't build a country like that. You have to build a country based on the common interests of everyone collectively. So Yaakov Avinu understood that whenever Klal Yisrael ultimately encounters a moment of national coalescence, there has to be an emphasis on the power of the individual. And that is so much what the message of Parshas Vayechi is. And in fact, when Yaakov Avinu tries to reveal to the Shvatim, the Gemara tells us in Pesachim, Yaakov Avinu bikesh legalos lahem es haketz. He wants to reveal to them the end of days, the messianic era. Why does he want to do this? Because he knows they're about to go into Golos Mitzrayim. He wants to give them a vision of hope. a vision of a Mashiach, a vision of a utopian world where everything will be great. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says the Gemara, withholds that revelation from Yaakov Avinu. And the Gemara says that Yaakov became full of consternation. How is that possible? Maybe they're not roi, maybe they're not capable, they're not privileged, they're not appropriate to ultimate Mashiach. I had a Rebbe in high school who would say the following, one of the most destructive things that was ever said to me. He would say the following. He looked up, we were all in sheer, nobody was listening to anything. And he looked up at us and he said, "Boys, when you die," which is always a great way to start with high school kids, "when you die, you're going to go into Shemayim and there's going to be a Shtender and there's going to be a Gemara. And for some of you, this will be heaven. And for some of you, this will be hell." This was our vision of... So Yaakov Avinu is all nervous. Maybe they're not roi to this godless. So the Gemara tells us that the Shvatim respond to Yaakov, "Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad." A declaration of faith, an affirmation of belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And to that, Yaakov Avinu responds, "Baruch Shem Kivod Machuso Li'olam Va'eh." That HaKadosh Baruch Hu's blessedness is forever. Because the enduring ability of Klal Yisrael to maintain its role in the world is dependent on each and every individual's capacity to say Shema Yisrael, each and every individual's ability to summon from within themselves their own sense of commitment, their own personal journey, their own particular approach, opting in, not because you're part of a system and a framework, but because you choose to opt in, you choose to be a part of it. In fact, there is a great debate amongst the Achronim if the principle of Shomea Ka'onim, of being motzi mitzvos through somebody else, applies to Kriya Shema. The Mishnah Berurah is makel and allows one to do that, but it seems that the Shitas HaRambam is it can only happen through a tzivi. One person can't do it for another. And the Rav writes in the Rishimos on Sukkah, in the name of the Rav, the reason for that is because you need Kabbalah Sol Malchus Shamayim. That has to be a personal experience. You can't do that for someone else. You could lay in the Megillah for someone else. You could make Kiddush for someone else. But you can't accept your mission in life for someone else or through someone else. We are all part of a larger educational journey, system, world. And very often, we, as part of this larger context, we're in a yeshiva, we're in Eretz Yisrael, we're on a joint program, we're not on a joint program, we go back, we don't go back, we go to this institution, we go to that institution, and it's very common to begin to define oneself based on an institution, based on a collective, based on a national experience. And that's so much a part of our identity, it's so much a part of who we are. But our ultimate capacity for success lies not within our deference and commitment to a particular system. Our ultimate capacity for success lies within our own free will, our own choice, our own decision to make something important, to make something central. Life is a canvas. It's a cloth. It's a parchment. And you can let that parchment be written on its own. You can allow the circumstances of your life to simply unfold, black on white, and it'll fill that scroll from the beginning of your life to the end. And you'll turn around at the end and you'll say to yourself, "I made it. I'm in group one. I have everything I could ever dream of, everything I could ever want. Except one thing. A sense of meaning and purpose and impact that I made on the world." Because the alternative is not to let those circumstances write themselves. That doesn't make a Sefer Torah holy. What makes a Sefer Torah holy is when we pick up the pen and begin to write it on our own. When we make the choice to scribe our trajectory of life in the way we want to see it go. To express and manifest the values that are central to us to live the ideals of the legacy that we carry from those who came before us, to push the Jewish people forward, because Am Yisrael is only as strong as the individual shvatim that comprise its larger entity. The Jewish people is very large, but there's so much of it that is functioning without any direction, without any knowledge, without any understanding, without any depth. And I'm not talking about religious versus non-observant versus non-observant. I'm talking about Jews that live meaningful, impactful lives versus Jews who live lives that just simply run on their own, no matter how many mitzvahs you observe. The way to write a Sefer Torah, the way to be boher and to choose the world of Shema Yisrael, the way to move Am Yisrael forward, the way to reach that Kates that Yaakov was aiming for, is for us to make a decision to take achrayas, to take responsibility for our own future. I am zocheh to spend a tremendous amount of time. I work at YU, all of you know that. I know you're connected to the yeshiva. And YU is an amazing place, and especially now there's a new president of YU. There's tremendous energy and enthusiasm and change, and it's a very dynamic environment. It's very special. It's a very incredible place to be. But it's not about YU. It's not about which institution you sign up for. It's about which context you put yourself in that's going to ultimately allow you the space to become the greatest person that you could become. I obviously think that Yeshiva University provides tremendous opportunity for so many people. Not everyone, but for so many people. But this isn't about me, and this isn't about YU. This is about you. This is about a decision that we all make to write our Sefer Torah, and to write the direction of our life, and to ultimately live it with a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, a sense of impact and transformation on the rest of the world. I wish all of you an amazing year. Have a wonderful day. Wow.